Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and, well, we are living through one of the most exceptional periods of human existence, defined on one side by extraordinary technological advances and on the other side by ecological and resource limits that we're just starting to bump up against. And I think although it's really tempting to think of this time being different, it won't be. Not really. If history doesn't repeat, it sure does rhyme. And if looked at correctly, history is not names and dates strung along in a blur marked by events, but rather it has a structure that repeats, a grand motif that plays over and over again, but maybe with different notes. To help us get our bearings today is Neil Howe, an American historian, economist, demographer, and best known for his work with William Strauss on social generations and generational cycles in American history, including the book The Fourth Turning. He is currently president of Life Course Associates, a consulting company he founded with Strauss to apply their generational theory to real-world business and governance practices. He is also a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies on their Global Aging Initiative and a senior advisor to the Concord Coalition, and we are just delighted to have him with us today. Welcome, Neil.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. This is great to be here.
Excellent. Well, I want to start with The Fourth Turning, which walks the reader through, I guess, what, 500 years of Anglo-American history and reveals a cyclical pattern that repeats itself about every 80 years or so, the length of a long human life, I guess. Can you tell us about that cycle and its components for people who haven't read the book so we can start with that?
Well, this was a pattern, actually, that we discovered indirectly simply by looking first at differences in generations throughout American history. We did a book back in 1991 called Generations, and it was really a history of America told from the viewpoint of separate generations, mm-hmm. you know, being, you know, formed young and coming of age, midlife leaders and parents growing old, and we found that each group saw itself very differently than even neighboring generations and certainly had different attitudes and behaviors collectively. But as we looked at it, not only did we see that century after century, we saw these very different generations follow each other, we found that the differences actually had a pattern within them. And of course, since, you know, generations are shaped by history, it means if there's a pattern in generations, there's a pattern in history itself. And indeed, what we saw, and not just in America, but in most other non-traditional societies, societies that have broken free of tradition, we find an oscillation of society between periods of political and economic and outer institutional reconstruction, and eras which have been called by some social historians awakening eras, where we rebuild our the world of values, morality, and religion. That is to say, a more of an internal reconstruction. It's often been noted that the great external turning points, political, constitutional turning points of American history, often marked by total war, occur about every 80 or 90 years apart. We're familiar with the Great Depression and World War II, the Civil War, the American Revolution, going back before that, the gigantic struggle of the War of Spanish Succession and the Glorious Revolution, which has played a big part not just in Europe but in American colonial life and so on in earlier periods. But it's also true that roughly halfway in between these periods of sort of outer world reconstruction, we have these periods of acute inner world trauma that, in, at least in American history, have been called the Great Awakenings of American history. And they've actually, as you know, been given numbers. There's the first Great Awakening, which date back to John Winthrop or Jonathan Edwards, and then there's the second and the third. And it's interesting that many historians call the late 60s and 70s, America's fifth Great Awakening, showing many of the same attributes from the interest, you know, everything from the violence and risk-taking by the young who lash out against an elder-built world, usually built by, you know, veterans of the last great struggle, to to an interest in cultural creativity, personal exploration. Interestingly, even substance abuse typically peaks in these periods. And of course, before the fabrication of modern drugs, that was a huge surge in alcohol consumption per capita, which we can actually trace going all the way back to the 17th century. These are patterns which have been unearthed by social historians separately. So there's a tremendous literature on these. It's not as though we're sitting there doing huge amounts of primary research. What we did simply in the fourth turning was to say there is a metronome, there's a governor of these cycles that people notice, cycles of realigning elections, of, you know, the K-wave or the Kondratiev cycle, the long wave in economics, cycles in family life and religion and culture. All of these things are governed by this basic rhythm of generational change, all having, as you pointed out, this ultimate long cycle of 80 or 90 years, this long human life you talked about. We chose the word saeculum to describe it. Saeculum is the Latin word meaning century, but it's interesting. It's not related to centum or the word century from 100. It's an old Etruscan word in Latin, and it originally meant the length of a long human life. It was simply that. Saeculum is not exactly 100 years. It's just kind of, you know, a long time, as long as anyone can remember. Uh-huh. And indeed, so some of the most interesting theories of generational cycles, actually one that was most famously articulated by Arnold Toynbee, was that the great wars in history occur because of generational forgetting. And the reason you have these great conflagrations every 80 or 90 years apart is because the generation that doesn't remember the last war, even as children, when they become elder political leaders, lead the world into and through the next war, right?
Mm-hmm. All right, so these generations, these four turnings, the archetypes that you've outlined are going from hero to artist to prophet to nomad. Where are we right now in these turnings?
Well, these are the generations, and of course they move through all turnings. They're just at different ages, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The turnings themselves are you know, sort of move from spring to fall to summer to winter. We actually number them. We talk about first, second, third, fourth turning. The first turning is what we call a high, and this is and each of these turnings is about 20 or so years long, about the length of a phase of life. Think about the time between being born and coming of age fully as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And the first turning is a high. And these are periods which are post-crisis periods of progress and conformity. You know, individualism is weak, institutions are strong and forward-looking. You know, minorities and anything that's outside the mainstream is kind of pushed off to the side of anyone's consciousness. Vernon Parrington called these the great barbecues of American history.
All right.
We think of the American high of the presidencies of Truman and Eisenhower and John Kennedy. And these are typically periods when the artist archetype is coming of age in a world that was just built just before they arrived, and typically a very conformist generation. We think of the generation that was given the label silent, the silent generation, in a famous Time magazine essay in 1951. And these are people born in the late 1920s, 1930s, early 1940s. Today, they're mainly in their 70s and 80s today.
Mm-hmm.
The next turning we call an awakening. This mm-hmm. is our second turning. An awakening as well, I just described it. It's one of the, these are the great awakening eras in American history. This is a time when people tire of the social conformity, spearheaded by a new generation that doesn't remember the last crisis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they lash out at all the social discipline. They want to throw it off. Everyone wants to find themselves, who they are authentically as individuals again. Most recently, we all recall the period of the most of the 60s, 70s, maybe early 80s. We went from a rebellion in the culture, mainly on college campuses,
mm-hmm.
To ultimately a rebellion in the economy, anti-tax movements, anti-regulatory movements. The whole motive of this whole thing was throw off social obligation. And pretty soon it involved all the members of particularly the generation coming of age, both on the right and the left, to a degree which I think even today they don't realize how much they took part in the same general ideology, which is mainly free the individual from control.
Mm-hmm.
And then we entered a third turning. We sometimes call these in our works the unraveling.
Okay.
Third turnings are the opposite of first turnings. In a third turning, institutions are weak and discredited. Individualism is strong and flourishing. You think of third turning decades, these are all decades of cynicism and bad manners. You think of the 1990s or the 1920s or the 1850s, 1760s, these are times when civic authority feels exhausted and the culture feels frenetic. And people do what works for themselves,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of my favorite Xer slogans is things like, you know, just do it, or it works for me.
Uh-huh.
I love that one. It works for me. I really don't care if it works for you or not.
Yep.
It's interesting, when you go into a bookstore recently, all the most upbeat books are about me, myself, and I, right? How I can solve anything. I can conquer the world, right? I have mm-hmm. unbelievable confidence in myself. Any book title today having to do with anything we share collectively is downbeaten and pessimistic. You know, the end of family, the end of community, the end of society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the third turning mood. And then most recently, I think our society has entered a fourth turning. And these are 20-year periods. You know, you're not just into it and out of it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the lesson of history is that third turnings always ultimately culminate in a fourth turning. It's a season you have to move through before you are born again, so to speak, as a society and regain institutional confidence, right? You have to go through a crucible to get there. I think the fourth turning started in probably, if I were to date it now, it would be 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly a realigning election in that year of Obama, Barack Obama against John McCain, and obviously simultaneously with that, as we all recall, an epic, historic crash of the global economy from which we still have not recovered. We're sort of hobbling along in kind of a low Earth orbit with continued, you know, high unemployment and excess capacity, not just in the United States, but around the world. And of course, all the rules of economic policy seem to have been, are broken and lying in fragments on the floor. People are wondering, what the heck do we do in this new era? And I think that this is a period when, in each of these turnings, each generation is moving into a new phase of life. Boomers are beginning to retire. They're beginning to redefine the senior phase of life. Xers are beginning to assume midlife roles as the dominant parent generation and leaders. These are people born in the 60s and 70s. And millennials are fully beginning to come of age and redefine young adulthood. And meanwhile, a very small generation is just beginning to come on stream, which remembers nothing before 2008. And these are the kids now just entering the first couple of years of elementary school. We can already see these generational divisions forming. And it's interesting how each generation is to some extent defined by the thing they just have no memory of. They just barely have no memory of. Boomers are defined by the World War II that even the oldest of them cannot remember, right?
Yep.
Gen Xers are defined by the American High, which I would say was anything up to and until the assassination of John Kennedy, when everything began to change so much rapidly after that in 1963. That's an event that even the oldest Xer has no memory of. And millennials have no memory of the consciousness revolution and all the family and social experimentation of the 60s, 70s, early 80s. It's all over by the time they came, you know, were first looking around. So for a millennial in school today, you know, Woodstock is an SOL question. It's as far removed from them as the New Deal is for a boomer like myself. And that's how generations move. And, of course, each generation needs to correct and compensate for the excesses of the generations that came before, often the midlife generation when they're coming of age in youth.
Well, this is fascinating. You mentioned some of the self-help books you might find on the shelf during the unraveling, sort of the me approach. And when I look at where we are today, if we look at just the economic crisis of 2008 as maybe being a dividing line and certainly a precipitating point for the fourth turning, that was really brought about, I think, characterized best by the attitude that Dick Cheney espoused, where, you know, he said deficits don't matter. And just economically, if we look at what happened from about 82 to about 2007-8 when it cracked, was we were racking up debts at a far faster rate than income. So you can measure that by debt to GDP. You could look at that household debt levels compared to income, all of these things. But this was basically the idea that we could just borrow and borrow more faster than we were earning. And it sort of got institutionalized culturally and actually in institutions and maybe politically. And now when we get into the fourth turning, so here we are in crisis, how is it that a generation either sheds or deals with what I would call an entrenched fallacy that maybe the prior generation is preserving at potentially any cost? Is that a fair way to look at it? And do you have a view on that?
Well, generations deal with it because they have no other choice. You know, I'm down here in Washington, D.C., and at least some of my life is dealing with public policy issues such as what to do about the extreme imbalance of our fiscal policy. And it's not just to sort of add to what you explained. It's sort of worse than just the explicit debt we've been piling up. There's also all the implicit debt, which are the unfunded liabilities of all the benefits we've promised to ourselves, which no one alive today has any intention of paying in taxes.
Right, of course.
Which is, you know, possibly up to $100 trillion present value in unfunded liabilities.
Yeah.
We can't possibly afford the government we've promised ourselves. And that will be a painful process of deleveraging. And it's not just deleveraging the explicit debt that we've already actually formally borrowed. It's all the implicit debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we will deal with it because we have no other choice. I wrote my first book, actually, with Pete Peterson back in 1988 called On Borrowed Time, and it was on this huge fiscal imbalance that we could see back then. You know, we had these tables showing Medicare and Social Security by the year 2020, 2040. Back then, we had all the time in the world to take care of it.
Yeah.
The silent generation was retiring. It was a small generation. A huge generation of boomers was paying, you know, all their FICA taxes, and all their spouses were working, and we had increasingly, pushed toward surplus. In fact, by the very late 1990s, as you recall, we were in a formal surplus. Do you remember? That was just before GW took over. But we completely squandered that window of opportunity, and now it's gone. You know, now we no longer have that leeway. But my point is this: no one simply solves a terrible problem on a sunny day when they can afford, at least for the time being, to look the other way. Problems like that are faced when people have no other choice, and it's a really grim day, and it's white knuckle time, and horrible things are happening with markets around the world, or horrible things are happening, at least historically, we've seen that geopolitically around the world, and that's when people are forced to act. Remember that we passed the original Social Security Act, which completely reshaped the role of modern government in 1935 at the depths of the Depression. And I think that's what we have to recall. These things occur when we don't want to do them. We have no other choice. We will be greatly aided by the fact that the generation which was extremely civically cohesive joined every political movement and always acted in unison with their own generational interests to a surprisingly degree, and that was the GI generation, also known as the Greatest Generation, right? They
mm-hmm.
they all joined the union movement back in the 30s and 40s, and then as soon as they started retiring in the 60s, they all became AARP members, and we called old people, all of a sudden we called them senior citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that younger Americans felt really had earned any public benefits, you know, that they thought they deserved, we paid, because they did create the system, right?
Yeah,
we
right.
knew that. So whatever they wanted, we said, okay, you've got it.
Yep.
And they defended it. They defended those benefits. And they created the system of entitlements. And to some extent, the silent generation, which Richard Easterlin, the demographer, calls them the lucky generation, because
mm-hmm.
they've always done so well economically in their lives. You know, Woody Allen has that joke about 80% of life is just showing up, right?
Yep.
I don't know any Xer who believes that's true about their careers.
Yeah.
But anyway, they've enjoyed it. But I think the advantage now is that Boomers and Xers don't have that political cohesion, and they will not fight. At least they will not fight effectively to preserve those benefits. I talk a lot to Boomers. We do a lot of surveys of people in their 50s and early 60s, and I would say most Boomers are completely philosophical about those benefits. They say, yeah, I don't know. I didn't really earn them. I mean, you know, I don't know where they came from. I know I've paid a lot of taxes, but I was never counting it. And as for senior citizens, no one is going to call Boomers senior citizens. The term is already falling into disuse for the silent generation.
Mm-hmm.
And no Xer is going to call an ex-Woodstock hippie a senior citizen. It's just not going to happen. So basically, the Boomers are just going to relinquish hold. And we already see Boomers preparing for it because they're all working. None of them are retiring.
Right.
Here's an interesting statistic about the economy. Since the peak of employment, all-time peak of employment was in September of 2007. And since then, the economy has lost 3 million jobs from then to today. But here's the killer. We've lost 6 million under age 60. We've gained 3 million over age 60.
Mm-hmm.
Over age 60, we've actually continued to gain jobs almost every month since the fall of 2007. It's amazing. These Boomers are not retiring. And a lot more of them are continuing to work. We do surveys of expected retirement ages. They're now beginning to go up in age. So it's an interesting adjustment. But I think, in other words, I guess what I'm saying to you is, I think we're already adjusting. I think we're already deleveraging. And I think that's already shaping some of the mood of the fourth turning as we speak.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I note in my work, I think I can grossly characterize the economic and fiscal split between Boomers and Millennials like this. The Boomers actually have everything to gain by preserving the status quo, and the Millennials have nothing to gain but plenty to lose by preserving the status quo. And I'm referring to the status quo here as ever-increasing amounts of debt being incurred as a means to preserve current spending levels, yet almost none of that borrowing is really going towards long-term infrastructure improvements or other tangible investments that I think the millennials can look at and say, yeah, that's to my benefit. Is this gap real? And if so, how is it going to resolve itself? I know you mentioned before it resolves during crisis, but how would you see that playing out?
Well, it is real, and we have to see how it plays out. You know, you're going to have some groups of silent Boomers who will dig in their feet. I mean, there's no question about it. I guess what I meant was it's ultimately not going to be effective, because today's retiring generations, I should say retiring generation, does not have the moral clout, you know, the legitimacy in the eyes of other generations for those benefits, not the way that the GI generation did, and they're not they don't have an instinct for organizing the same way that the GIs did, so they will lose that fight. But it's interesting. When you look at attitudes of millennials, millennials are, as you know, a pro-government generation. They believe government ought to be doing much more for the community than Xers and boomers, which is why they, in the last couple of elections they've had this, they voted much more for the Democratic Party than older people. We've seen this in this very large, suddenly a very large age gap in partisanship. But I would qualify that by saying, if you look closely at what millennials want, they want government to invest, in their future. They want the social infrastructure. They want the physical infrastructure. They don't want a government dominated by entitlements to individuals. That's their parents' thing, right? That's the world their parents inhabit. It's not the world that they really want for themselves. And so they do think more than older people that these programs need to be reformed and their future growth needs to be cut. I think what allows these generations to avoid bitter conflict, which could be a bitter conflict, is the fact that in their personal lives, these two generations get along so well together. This is something one of the more remarkable generational trends recently is how well 20-somethings get along with their boomer parents. We follow surveys on this. We've never seen a time since the end of World War II in which teenagers and college-age students, so many of them say they have no problem with their parents. They get along just great with them. According to the UCLA freshman poll, the share of college kids who say they want to live near their parents has nearly doubled over the past 15 years. And we see a record share of them, as you know, living at home. The share of 25 to 34-year-olds living at home has gone up from 11% back in 1980 to 22% today. And it's not just the economy. One of the things you're seeing for the first time is millennials, even after they get a full-time job, they still live with their parents. I'm noticing that around here. They get to save for their first mortgage, they get to save for their marriage. The disappearance of the culture gap between generations is very significant today. Young people and their parents, they watch the same movies, they listen to the same music, they wear the same brand name clothing, they talk about problems in their lives to an extent that boomers never did with their own parents. And this is a pattern also. It's interesting that the greatest generation, who are great in so many things, had some real problems, had some real failures as parents. I think one of the greatest tragedies and disappointments of the greatest generation was that they were so distant from their own kids. They had recalled being so close to their own parents, back in the 20s and 30s when they were growing up, but they were so distant from their own kids.
Yeah.
And there was such an enormous values gulf from their own kids. And similarly, I'm noticing when I talk to boomers today that the biggest surprise for boomers is they're so close to their own kids. They expected, given their own early life, right, that their own parents, their own kids would just, just give them the finger and take off. And they're not. They're hanging around. They're not going anywhere. There's a very positive side of this, actually, and that is if extended family life becomes much closer over the next couple of decades, this could hugely ease and relieve pressure on third-party entitlement payment programs and allow families to deal with resource issues internally that we now rely on public programs for, and it could ease the burden on our tax system and on government, and allow government to spend on things or invest in things which truly benefit our collective future.
Well, this is something I want to turn to now, which is given that we're in the fourth turning and it's marked, I guess its placeholder name is crisis, And as we look through past periods of crisis, there's a lot of wars embedded in that list. That seems to be one of the defining things that comes up. But what I'm really interested in is using this fascinating information. What do we do with it? Knowing that we're in crisis, that it started in 2008, we've got 20 years of it in front of us. Based on history, what can we expect? And I'm really interested what we might be able to expect economically, but also politically. What are the big trends that we could sort of count on happening here, knowing that, if I've got this right, we're pretty early on in the crisis stage, this fourth turning?
Well, in the fourth turning, we actually lay out a morphology of how fourth turnings usually progress. I mean, it starts with a catalyst, something which pushes us a little bit over the edge and out of the third turning. Mm-hmm. I think we already had that. I mean, that was 2008. Suddenly everyone kind of realizes the world is different now. You know, all the jokes and TV shows about the new normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. Yeah. We're in the new normal now. And so we're there. Okay, the next thing that's going to happen, which has not happened yet, it goes from the catalyst to what we call the regeneracy.
Regeneracy.
That's when there begins to emerge somewhere amid the despair, the hopelessness, the individualism, the centripetal motion of American society toward billions of pieces and separate interests, and the world seems to be in chaos, that there is a nexus, a political party, an interest group, somewhere in society, a place where people begin to reacquire social trust. And this begins to spread outward toward this gradual sense that, you know, there is some force out there which people can join, people can feel part of some sort of sense of community. And this isn't necessarily a formal organization. I'm not talking necessarily about a political party. It's usually the last thing to actually join this movement. But it's a sense among Americans that they have something in common collectively which is positive energy, and usually focused on the rising generation, which in this case would be millennials. I think everyone is sort of amazed at how millennials have this confidence about their future. I just did a story, just interviewed yesterday by the LA Times. She interviewed me, and she says she doesn't understand. She's looking at all these opinion polls, and it just says that 20-somethings are just so confident and optimistic about the future. She said, How could they be? You know, I don't get it. All these boomers are tearing their hair out and contemplating suicide, but these young people are so confident. Well, you know, remember in the 1930s, it was the coming-of-age generation, the GI generation, that was confident, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the 40s, they were all singing songs like Accentuate the Positive, and, you know, everything was upbeat for that generation. That finally became a pathology for boomers, right? We couldn't stand that quality of the GIs. You know, they were just always optimistic.
Yep.
And finally, it forced many of us to just, we were like Meathead and with Archie Bunker, right, just screaming in their face. But the point is that we see that in millennials today, and ultimately that will cause a regeneracy, and the regeneracy will be a growing movement of confidence among Americans, which will eventually attach itself to organizations, political movements, and will allow us to organize ourselves out of our problems and design long-term solutions for them. Ultimately, the next stage in a crisis is the climax. That's when we're finally organized to do the right thing, but of course, everything on the problem side is worse, right?
Yep.
And you know, in our last fourth turning, all the problems of the world, the depression, the trade wars, fascism, everything became one big problem, and that was World War II, right?
Yep.
Total victory, and then that had a climax, which was, you know, probably sometime in the fall of 1942 and the beginning of 1943, where we suddenly realized, you know, we were probably going to win this thing. And that typically happens at a fourth turning. All the different problems, all the different struggles, all coalesce into one big struggle. And there's a climax. And then the final moment of the fourth turning is the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when all the treaties are signed, all the new institutions are created, you know, the cement is wet, so the things are free to be shaped any way you want them, and people are going to become masterminds of a whole new global system, which is, you can imagine, the next at the end of this fourth turning, it's all going to be aided and abetted by, you know, millennials designing these enormous, you know, information technology systems to make sure that we're all looked after, like in the game of, you know, Sims or something. A giant Sim City,
uh-huh.
Right, is going to be the world, and that's going to be the new Bretton Woods, the new World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations. Right, that's
yep.
going to be a whole new global infrastructure that will set the stage for the next first turning, an era suddenly of surprising social stability and general optimism about the future. And ultimately, a period that will be the object of growing resistance and scorn by yet another generation who will find it soul dead and arid culturally, right? Valueless.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, history keeps moving, right, Chris? There's no, you know, the ebb and flow doesn't stop, right? One solution always gives rise to another problem.
Ah, interesting. So I want to turn back to where we are in this story, which is somewhere between catalyst and regeneracy, and
yes.
that sense of community, because community is something that we hearken on a lot in my community, and we talk about it, and I see people searching for it. If I could define it this way, there's a sense of people are seeking something they know is missing, and they want more of this thing called community, maybe with a loose internal definition of what that is. You know, they'll know it when they see it.
Right.
And I think back to things like the Grange movement, which, you know, really, you know, people self-organized for a set of purposes. And I'm seeing transition town movements today and other still early. They feel early. People grasping for how do we put this back together? Also a sense that current life as it is configured, if you're living within the framework of the dominant culture, is fairly isolated, is fairly shallow from a cultural standpoint. Many connections aren't really all that deep, either at work, with neighbors, sometimes with family itself, and that there's a sense that we want to re-deepen that. Is that what you mean by regeneracy? Is that a coming back of community?
I think that's absolutely right. And we see it, I see it among a lot of Xers and millennials trying to live it. A lot of Xers who have not re-entered the formal economy, you know, we've seen a huge exodus from the formal labor force, from people aged 25 to 55. And you know, they're not counted as unemployed, right? So
mm-hmm.
we've sort of hidden this problem.
Yeah.
But they are, part of what they're doing is they're doing things in their community. They're obviously, you know, Gen Xers are big do-it-yourselfers, and they're beginning to regenerate the community that way. It's interesting that Frederick Lewis Allen, who wrote so many wonderful books about the 1920s and 30s as he lived through them, when he wrote about the 30s, he described it as the decade of community and belonging. He said the 20s were all about. You know, Babylon, and we're all about moving to the cities and jazz, and you know, just sort of losing yourself in the urban throngs and doing wild things. He said the 30s, everything changed. It was everyone wanted to become to bond themselves with their neighbor, their locality, their region. This was the time when you know Roosevelt and his brain trust were inventing all these alphabet soup agencies
mm-hmm.
and patches and badges where you can identify yourself with. It was a great seed time for community and professional organizations in America. I think it was local color in the fiction. We had all these local color writers. Everyone remembers the WPA murals, right, which show these people all in groups, you know, pulling and hauling at common causes, right? It was these murals that are now on our train stations and our airports around America. And I think that's what we recall from the 30s. And it's going to be very interesting. That mood, which is so much infused by this coming-of-age, very team-oriented GI generation back then, is going to be very interesting to locate over the next decade. And that's going to be the spirit of America. I mean, that's going to be the thing which changes us as a people and ultimately gives us the power to solve these huge challenges that we face and are going to manifest itself, I think, in further economic and geopolitical crises, because I feel that the kind of economic recovery that we've had so far is inherently stunted and unstable. You know, it depends upon this forced hot air and kind of greenhouse armor plating of Ben Bernanke's bond purchases.
Yep.
And it also depends upon the fact that the labor market is hugely underutilized, right, and that we have no labor pressure for wages. And sort of as long as we kind of stay in this, it's what I call this low Earth orbit, you know, the economy kind of functions. But as soon as we go back to full capacity, nothing's going to work anymore. And so we're teetering between the forces of deflation and the forces of inflationary forces of full capacity, which we cannot possibly handle. This quantitative easing is like the roach motel to me. The Fed chairman can go in, but I don't know how he gets out. Right?
Mm-hmm. There is no way out.
I don't know how he goes out. We have corporate earnings that are at a record share of national income today.
Mm-hmm.
If that reverts to mean, you can just imagine what happens to the S&P 500, which basically means you need, you know, the economy right now, at least the stock market, to function depends upon zero wage pressure. So I'm nervous. I'm nervous about the future right now. I think we have a lot more deep issues, deep crises to face in the economy. I'm also very nervous about what I see geopolitically, and this is another analogy to the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Eurozone is going to break up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to start with Southern Europe, and it's not going to be because of sovereign debt default. Mario Draghi can always write a bigger check than any investor, you know, trying to bet against him. So
yep.
That was never an issue. The issue is political disaffection from a euro, which has become a prison for Southern Europe. It's the euro for Southern Europe today is what the gold standard was back in the 1930s. It is
yep.
a jail for those societies. Greece today would be vastly better off if they had gone back to the drachma back when this thing first
yes.
surfaced in 2008.
Yep.
They would already be eligible today for new credit. I mean, if Argentina is any guide, they would have everything renewed, and they would have a competitive currency.
Yep.
It boggles my mind that these countries have stayed in it. Well, here's what's interesting, that the euro was designed by a generation who wasn't really interested. Well, they were partly interested in economic integration, but what they really wanted was to assure that Europe would not fight any more wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was the war child generation of World War II, who were fanatics about European unity. And you still see these guys in their 70s. Many of them are still, you know, in official capacities in the EU. And they are diehard advocates of staying in the euro. But younger generations just don't get it. They don't remember any of that.
Yep.
And you see younger people in Europe, they're the ones who think national anthems are fine. They love their country's flags. We see huge changes in community and national identification of younger people in Europe. And perhaps more ominously, we see some of those same changes in East Asia. I mean, look at the phenomenon of Shinzo Abe. Look at the new generation of leaders in China. We see rising nationalism there, and this worries me. I look a lot at, as you can imagine, Chris, I look a lot at analogies to the 30s. I think we all remember what happened back then. And, you know, Abenomics. What is Abenomics except an effort to push deflation and unemployment onto other countries?
Mm-hmm.
I think the word which was used, it was coined by the Brazilian finance minister back in 2010. He called it currency wars, right? I think back in the 1930s, we called that beggar thy neighbor. But the point is that there are patterns here which we recognize. And it's very important not to have historical amnesia. To look back and see where we've been, see where we're going, and more importantly, to understand that the dynamics behind these social trends have familiar parallels. If we just have the historical imagination to look far enough backwards and forwards to see where else they have happened or to see where they possibly will happen again.
Well, Neil, you know, one place I see that very clearly, and tell me if I'm stretching this too far, but in the 30s we had this rise of fascism, and today we have this rise of corporatism. And one of the most important things, you know, I want to relate this to is this idea of what Abenomics is really trying to do. Let's be clear about something. This is a point I make over and over and over again, because the press gets this absolutely back-ass words time and time again. Deflation is not a bad thing if you're a consumer. Consumers love falling prices. I would love to know that college would be cheaper in 10 years for my kids than it is today. But deflation is a killer for banks. And that's a certainty, and for financial institutions. So when the Bank of Japan, in cahoots with Abe, says what we have to do is just create inflation at any cost, they're not doing that for the benefit of their society at large. The benefit, if there is one, would be ancillary. If their financial institutions are strong, the thinking goes, then the people benefit too, because then they have a better functioning economy. It's not a linkage I draw all the way through. I think sometimes they're confusing coincident indicators.
Well, the way I would put it is this: the problem with deflation is you know, when you see all these central bankers talk about that, and most economists will talk about that, it's the zero bound problem. You know, we can't lower interest rates lower than zero. So when you have deflation, it creates, and also the fact that you can't actually cut people's wages, all right? That just never happens. Nominal wages never get cut. If you can't cut interest rates below zero and you can't cut nominal wages, then a deflationary economy creates a very asymmetrically different situation than, you know, an economy that goes from 6% to 4% or 4% to 2%. You go to 2% to negative 2%, and you are in a huge new Alice in Wonderland place. And with shrinking capacity, shrinking labor, shrinking capital utilization, and that's when you do get a debt deflation spiral that actually involves a decline in GDP. There's a very interesting piece out. By the way, all of the people on what I call the reflationist left, you know, sort of the Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman and all these people who think mm-hmm. that governments aren't doing nearly enough to stimulate the economy, they all love Abenomics. I mean, they all love it. There's a paper out actually by Christina Romer, who's at UC Berkeley, and mm-hmm. she was, you know, the chairman of Barack Obama's CEA up until 2010. And it's a paper basically saying that Obama's effort to create inflation out of nothing, just by whatever means he can, by just bringing it out of his hat, right, just drawing this rabbit out of his hat, is exactly what FDR did in 1933, and he did it successfully, and my God, Shinzo Abe will do it successfully, and this is the best chance that Japan has. I mean, here's this group that is ecstatic about it, because this is what sort of the super Keynesian reflationist left wants, which always has wanted, which was enormous fiscal and monetary stimulus together to get these economies going again. Because once you have inflation, then you can create negative interest rates, right? Negative real interest rates by keeping interest rates low, and then you can really zoom the economy. You can create any kind of stimulus you want. And that's what they're after. It does have, obviously, to the extent that you're partly expanding through you know, dropping your interest rates and devaluing your currency, there is an extent which is comes at the expense of neighbor at the expense of trading partners in other countries. And it will breed resentment. China, for example, does not want to drop its interest rates. This has its own monetary problems, but it's going to suffer in terms of its trade with Abenomics. The European Union does not want to drop its interest rates, but they're going to suffer as the yen declines the way it has. So it's going to create animosities, and it's going to create problems. I think you're right about banks. You know what banks hate? Banks hate a flat yield curve uh-huh. because banks borrow short and they lend long, right? And if that yield curve has no slope, they're in trouble. I mean, that's what they don't like. So, you know, banks have been hurting lately, and I think you're right about that, because you look around the world and that that yield curve is pretty flat everywhere you look.
Well, sure. When I look at history of economics, though, we had periods of inflation and deflation prior to 1913. And they happened, and you had your whole Schumpeter creative destruction would come and go. And my analysis now says that what we did was we accumulated far too much debts, both implicit and explicit. And instead of allowing those to wash out, the central banks, I think, are, and I think rightly, they're afraid. They're afraid of what happens if this becomes a self-sustaining negative feedback spiral, as you say, because what will happen is all those bad debts will wash out. The pendulum will probably overswing. You'll probably clear out some okay ones, too. And it'll be a pretty nasty reset button. But really, that's a failing of the idea that the business cycle has been terminated. Greenspan, you know, rode out to slay the business cycle. He claimed victory on that front. I believe what he did was he stored potential energy for a future crisis. And, you know, the snow just accumulated on the cornice. It didn't actually dissipate. And so now we have a situation where I think you're right, they're in a box. They can't let deflation happen because it would be so awful. Yet at the same time, we don't have any of the ingredients you need for a proper inflation. So what do? Well, you just keep printing, you cross your fingers, you hope for the best. But like you, I have the sense that there's another shoe to drop. And that's, you know, the last part of this podcast with you. I'd love to know how do people insulate themselves or protect themselves or plan or invest, if you have advice there, but also how do corporations, institutions navigate this environment knowing with this sort of macro backdrop that you've got?
Well, I think, mainly to offer what seems obvious is to stay liquid, know exactly where your investments are. I think that as you know, the Ben Bernanke, as well as Abe and all these people that are pursuing QE, basically want to take away the returns on risk-free fixed rate instruments to push you into equities. I mean, they want to push you into riskier markets to get the economy going. The stock market, for the first time ever, has become an instrument of policy. We've never had that before. I think it's one of the most remarkable and sort of unobserved features of the last couple of years. That the stock market, you know, people say, oh, the stock market's going up. That must be great. Well, that always was the case because the stock market was always, you know, sort of investors acting sort of freely, giving their own sort of estimation of what the present values of future dividends and earnings were, right? I mean, that's what the stock market was. Now it's become an instrument of policy. By absolute design, people are being almost forced into investing in equities because the Fed is deliberately making every other option unprofitable or taking away any rate of return on it in order to get you to invest in that direction. And I think that that's why I said earlier this current rally has a hothouse quality to it. Mm-hmm. It's like a beautiful orchid, you know, growing in the middle of winter because there's this wonderful little construction that's been placed around it. So I don't trust this rally. I don't believe in it. And I think once it washes out, once it comes down, we'll be facing the same reality we were before. I tell people, you know, families to get more involved in your community. I mean, we know in forced earnings, everyone is going to require more, their neighbors, their friends, their region, their locality. And I find America is already drifting in that direction. If you look at, buy local movements and cash mobs and just all the stuff going on today. And you look at the surveys, you see this too. You know, Andy Coad, who runs the Pew Research Center, I mean, he says there's been this huge movement of the American public since, you know, just over the last decade away from, you know, globalism and all these belief in multilateral institutions. Everyone now believes in their own region, right? And I think that, you see that very strongly among the young. And I think to go with that, to become involved with that, because one thing that we recall from previous forced turnings is that there will be times in a fourth turning when your involvement in your community, being known to friends and being having contacts, people who know people who can help you in trouble, becomes very important, particularly people who know people in positions of power in government who can help you, because what government does becomes very important in a fourth turning. This is what I tell businesses. I tell, you know, in the 1990s, you didn't want to do anything with government. Stay off their radar screen. You know, maybe if you're really good, they won't even look for you to tax you. You know, today that's different. Today, you need to know what government is doing, because I think in the years to come, public authority could become extremely important and could suddenly acquire vast powers as the crisis elements we've talked about pose new dangers to people. So I think that's another thing people ought to do. I'm wary about investing in emerging markets. I find emerging markets are the tail end of the whip. You know, they've done really good under QE. You know, there's a kind of a carry trade now. You can borrow short in all these high income countries, and you can invest in these emerging market stock markets. I find that very risky. I would not do that. I think that when the high-income countries, particularly the United States, does badly again, those markets will come down the fastest, they'll come down the furthest. I think investing in Japan is a very interesting play right now. It's maybe for the strong of heart, if you're willing to do it. It's certainly, I think, Abenomics is assuming risk that may be uncorrelated with the rest of the world, and so if you want something that probably will not go up or down the same as, say, the EU or the dollar or the U.S. dollar in the U.S. markets, that may be an interesting play for diversification, because I think something special is going on there. It's going to be a difficult time. It's going to be a tough time. And let me just say further, on the question you asked about inflation, right now, unlike a lot of people, I do not see this as a fundamentally inflationary era. I see this as a fundamentally deflationary era. And I said that consistently since 2008. And I remember in all of those years, 2008, 9, and 10, and 11, just people constantly saying, oh, my God, hyperinflation is about to break out. You can't create all that money. You can't print all that money. But, that money that gets printed, that high-powered money that the Fed creates, just sits there. It sits there as excess reserves. It doesn't go in. It doesn't create M2. Money velocity is falling. People have no use for it. We have a deficit of trust today in the global economy. And when there's no trust, no money gets created. No credit becomes created. And so the fundamental forces of the world today remain deflationary. The CPI around the world is hitting record lows, even now, in the spring of 2013. 10-year public rates worldwide, and the IMF and the World Bank, they measure this stuff, is now at lowest rates ever since World War II, or since, going back even before then, probably to the Great Depression. Commodity prices, most remarkably, and Chris, you may have your own views about this, it's remarkable. They're down lately. Precious metals, energy, wood, amazingly. A lot of the constituent raw materials for construction you'd expect to go up if GDP any place were planning to go up. What's going on? Is it just China? Has China overstockpiled? What's going on here? I guess that's my final, comment, is don't discount the strength of the deflationary tide that is not just in America but around the world today. It's not abated yet.
Well, with that, we're going to draw this podcast to a close. Neil, you've been fantastic. Just if I could summarize what I heard, this is a time where I think one summary element was you were saying this is a time to avoid risk, knowing that the Federal Reserve and other central banks are really using stock market as an instrument of policy is one thing, but they're really pushing and shoving people towards risk with the idea that the tail can wag the dog. Maybe it can,
right.
Maybe it can't. But in the context of avoiding risk, you stay liquid, you know where your money is, you maintain and enhance connections with important people, government people particularly, if that makes sense for you, and community, because this, we're entering a period where community is going to be probably your greatest determinant of outcome and happiness as we go forward. Did I get that right?
I think that's, yeah.
All
nothing
right.
To disagree with there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been fascinating. We're going to post this at the site, spread this around. We're going to have a great discussion under it, because I think having this social construct and scaffolding to begin to understand where we are in this story is really, really helpful. Not just for knowing where we are, but potentially helping us understand where we're going. So I want to thank you for that.
Great. Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.